Unfortunately, Dr. Rebecca Dillingham cannot be with us today due to the fact that she is under the weather. However, at this time, I am both pleased and proud to introduce the speaker for today's seminar, Professor Robert Fatone, the Julia A. Cooper Professor of Government and Foreign Affairs and the Associate Dean for the Department of Politics. Born and raised in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, now an American citizen, Fatone studied in the mid-1970s in France, later earning a bachelor's degree from Goshen College in Indiana in 1976. He holds master's and doctoral degrees from the University of Notre Dame in Indiana. He has been teaching at the University of Virginia since 1981. Professor Fatone has served as chair of the Department of Politics from 1997 to 2004. He is the author of several books and a large number of scholarly articles. His most recent book is entitled The Roots of Haitian Despotism, which will be published this summer. Please join me in giving a warm welcome to Professor Fatone.
Yeah, it's a very small group, so I had a prepared text, so I'm not going to use it because we are such a small group. The first thing that I'll do is to show you some pictures that you may have seen already. I'm not very good with technology, but I'll try. And they will... Okay, so those are the pictures that were taken on January 12th during the earthquake. And I start with that building because that building was actually one of the key buildings in terms of the structures of the government. This is the tax building, as we called it. This is where tax were collected, etc. And it's falling. And then, obviously, that is part of the damage. This is a picture taken from the mountains during the earthquake. And the grayish stuff that you see there is essentially the consequence of the bricks, the dust that was created by the earthquake. And a few minutes after that, you couldn't see actually downtown. It was completely covered by that dust. This is part of the destruction, and you can see, and it's very much the whole of downtown Port-au-Prince was like that, flattened. This is the National Palace, which obviously was the symbol of the government. It collapsed too, not completely, and it's still standing very much that way, except the middle part has been, for all practical purposes, removed, but the construction of a new palace has not started yet. You can see the difference between the two pictures, so that gives you an idea. This is still the palace for... this is the typical thing that you would see downtown Port-au-Prince, and you can see that. So, this is the building of the MINUSTAH. This is the acronym for the United Nations Peacekeeping Force, which is in Haiti, and virtually all the staff of MINUSTAH died in the process. This is the remnant of a building that had something like 10 100 feet tall building, and this is the remnant. It just collapsed straight down, and all of the major officers of MINUSTAH were in there at the time of the earthquake, and virtually all of them died. Something like 103 of them died on that very day. This is a picture taken, obviously, from a plane, and it shows you, this is a soccer field that became part of the camp. And you can see all of those little things there. Those are tents. And that has not changed significantly either. There were about 1 million or so people compelled to move to those camps. And we still have probably something like 800,000 to 900,000 living in the same conditions. And if you go now, many of the tents which used to be blue have become really very pale because of the sun. And this is another picture of the camps. This is another one. And this is downtown Port-au-Prince. You can see those are makeshift. That's very much what you still see. This is a picture taken. It's in Pétionville on the hills, and you can see the destruction. Virtually all of the houses there collapsed. They were very poorly built, and not surprisingly, this is the consequence of the earthquake. This is a tent. This is one of the better kept camp. It's about 6 miles away from Port-au-Prince. One of the problems is that it's very isolated. There are no jobs, and it is certainly not a solution to the problem of the camp people. Here you can see Bill Clinton and Bush and the president of Haiti, Préval. This is a few weeks after the earthquake when both Clinton and Bush were in fact in charge of some organization to provide assistance to Haiti. Here you see them again. And this, I put the picture of this fellow. This is Michel Martelly. He may well be the next president of Haiti. The results were supposed to have been announced yesterday, but as usual, there have been delays and there have been accusations of fraud. So the results are supposed to be announced on Monday. The preliminary tallies showed that he won overwhelmingly, but the electoral councilors argued that many of the tallies were fraudulent. So something like 15% of those tallies have been removed. So it remains to be seen whether he is going to be, in fact, the president. If he is not, this would be the president of Haiti. This is Miolande Maniga, and she is an intellectual, and she has been involved in politics for a long time. She is also the wife of a former Haitian president, Leslie Maniga, who was deposed actually in a coup in 1987. So it's going to be either Maniga or Martelly. So those are the pictures. So let me now get into a little bit more of the discussion. As you know, they, I don't know if that can go on, but the earthquake clearly was devastating for Haiti, not only in terms of the number of people who died. I mean, it's estimated that anything between 220,000 to 300,000 people died in the earthquake. So it's a colossal catastrophe, but it is also the catastrophe in terms of the infrastructure of the country. Virtually all governmental buildings were destroyed, which means that the government, which was already quite weak and quite incompetent, virtually vanished in the aftermath of the earthquake. One of the fascinating things that occurred after, immediately after the earthquake, was the fact that there was no government. The president essentially didn't talk to the population for 2 weeks. The Minister of the Interior had this very strange thing to say, but which is symptomatic of the current situation. He said something to the effect that the government was not in the business of fixing those problems. That was the business of the international community and of the NGOs. And this is a very important element to keep in mind when we talk about the future of the country. So the earthquake has clearly devastating consequences. But what was interesting is that in the midst of the cataclysm itself, there was a sense that Haitians may have actually created a new sense of solidarity. The earthquake was an equalizer in the sense that whether you were wealthy, poor, whatever class you may have been from, you were going to suffer the consequences. And for about 3 or 4 days, very wealthy people were in the streets with very poor people. And that's probably the very first time that those two different groups slept together, and they slept together in the street. So that generated the sense that maybe something different could crystallize after the earthquake and in the process of reconstruction. Unfortunately, at least this is my view, very quickly after that glimmer of solidarity, the old reflexes reasserted themselves. In other words, the big divide between the very small group of well-to-do Haitians and the vast majority of the population, that divide really became increasingly apparent and may have been reinforced. So while it is not unthinkable to imagine that you could have a new government, a new type of a new social contract between the wealthy minority and the rest of the population, I think this is unlikely. So we have the old problems that have been added to the destruction of the country. This is one aspect of the situation. The other aspect is the utter dependence of Haiti on external sources of power. The country's budget, for instance, is dependent on something like 70 to 75% in terms of foreign assistance. The current government is, to a large extent, a prisoner of the international community and of the World Bank, the Inter-American Bank, and the International Monetary Fund. And what I mean by prisoner is that the government has virtually no autonomy insofar as deciding its own economic policies. This is not decided by the Haitian government. It is really a function of the international community, and that dependence has increased as a result of the earthquake, because what has occurred is the creation of the so-called interim Haiti Recovery Commission, which was actually designed in the State Department, proposed to the Haitian government, and with a few amendments, it was voted into law, and probably unconstitutionally and illegally, but it was nonetheless voted into law by the parliament. And the interim commission is basically a commission that represents, on the one hand, the major powers and the major international financial institutions. In order to be a member, a foreign member of the commission, you needed to have given at least $100 million immediately, or $200 million over a period of 3 years. Or you needed to have canceled the whatever debt Haiti had vis-a-vis the particular country, and a debt of about $200 million. So you have the typical countries, major powers, and the United States, Canada, France, a part of that commission. There are other countries which are not obvious countries in that commission, like Norway, is Japan too. And then you have Venezuela. And then you have some of the Latin American countries which are part of MINUSTAH, Brazil and Argentina were represented. And the commission is represented by, on the one hand, the foreign contingent and the Haitian contingent, and they are represented equally. In reality, however, the commission is supposed to be the organism that is going to disburse the money that the international community has pledged after the earthquake. So we are talking about pledges that amounted to $5 billion over 3 years and $10 billion supposedly over 7 or 8 years. In reality, that money has yet to be effectively dispersed. Only something like 20% of it has been disbursed, and it may well be that the $5 billion will not amount to more than probably $3 billion. Usually, in those types of natural catastrophes, pledges that are made in the immediate aftermath of the catastrophe are significantly higher than what the country is going to get. You get about 40-50% of it, not more. So that's one issue. But the problem with the commission is that since it is really dominated by the donors, the Haitian government has very little say in the matter. Although supposedly the president has a veto power over the decisions, but the president has no money. So if the international community comes with a proposal to give money, it is very unlikely that the president would veto that particular decision. So for all practical purposes, the situation of Haiti now is a situation of virtual trusteeship. It's not a formal trusteeship, but it is a de facto trusteeship. The country does not have an army, has a very weak police, and whatever coercive forces that function in Haiti are those of the United Nations. So you have a government that has very limited capacity to do anything about the economy. You have a government that does not really have a police or a military force, and you have the interim commission, which is in charge, really, of disbursing the foreign money that is supposed to be coming for the reconstruction of Haiti. So when you look at Haiti now, it is in fact a virtual trusteeship. The political situation has been one of instability, as you know, and that instability has been exacerbated by the elections that were the first round of the elections, the presidential and parliamentary elections, were conducted last November. And what I mean by instability exacerbated by elections is that traditionally elections in Haiti are very dangerous moments. Very few elections in Haiti end up peacefully. The problem is that there is fraud, and that whomever loses the election does not accept peacefully and gracefully defeat. And in many instances, this is not surprising, because, in fact, they won. And they find out that the official results are not those that really corresponded to what most people thought was the actual vote. So elections are dangerous in Haiti. Now, it's a good thing to have elections, but when the elections in November took place, in November 28, you were talking about a situation whereby the whole infrastructure for the elections had disappeared. The Electoral Council building had been destroyed. You had about 300,000 people who had died, and no one knew exactly who died, and there were many of them were part of the regular list of voters. There was probably something like another 500,000 people who were of age to vote but could not register. A significant number of Haitians lost their cards in the earthquake. So you're talking about a totally disorganized electoral process. And it's very puzzling that the election did in fact take place, because many Haitians had hoped that after the earthquake there would be some sort of a provisional government of national unity, and then you would have eventually elections, but probably in 2 years or so, and you would have a different electoral council. But the international community and the current government were very much in favor of immediate elections. The international community, because they wanted to have a new government that was perceived as legitimate, and the current government headed by René Préval, because they thought that by organizing the elections, they could fix it in such a way that their own presidential candidate would in fact become president, and that parliament would be dominated by the party of René Préval, a party called Unité, which means unity. So the elections took place on the 28th. You had something like 19 presidential candidates, multiple political parties in the presidential and in the legislative elections. On the other hand, some groups were not allowed to participate. The reason given by the Electoral Council was that their paperwork was not sufficiently that was not legal. Now that was purely a political decision, and because the parties that had been marginalized were parties that had been associated to a large extent with the former president of Haiti, Jean-Bertrand Aristide. So his main party, the Lavalas party, was not allowed to participate, although there were other members of that party that had broken away from, if you wish, the wing representing Aristide and participated in those elections. In any case, the elections took place and they were a complete fiasco. The election started at 8 o'clock in the morning, very difficult to find where you could vote, etc. But by 12 in the afternoon, 12-1, all of the presidential candidates except the candidate of the governing party, a fellow by the name of Jude Celestin. So all of the presidential candidates, including those two fellows, Maniga and Martelly, went on national TV and on national radio saying that the elections were so bad that they should be stopped and that there was no way you could get a free and fair result. But as everything in Haitian politics, that changed very quickly because some members of the international community told Martelly and Maniga that, well, you know, if you had not stopped the election, you probably would be the top two candidates. 12 hours afterwards, both Maniga and Martelly said, well, the elections were quite bad, but they were not that bad. So we are prepared to accept them, because the international community actually told them that they would probably be number one and number two, so that meant that they would go to the second round. But there was a twist, because the Electoral Council, which is in the hands of Préval, decided, well, okay, Maniga is going to be in the second round, but our candidate is going to be also in the second round, and Martelly is not going to be in the second round. So the official results given by the Electoral Council gave Martelly the third position, and Celestin was the number two, and Maniga was number one. So the second round was going to take place between Maniga and Celestin. But Martelly didn't like that, and he decided, hell no, I'm not going to put up with that, so he put his people in the streets. And that immediately stopped the whole process. The Electoral Council then had a period whereby you can contest the results. And that didn't go very well. So ultimately, the international community, in particular the French and the Americans and the Canadians, got involved and said, well, this is not going to be acceptable. And they compelled the president to accept an OAS mission that would, in fact, look at the results and decide who was number one and who was number two. The problem with that is that it's clearly unconstitutional, illegal in terms of Haitian laws, but that's exactly what happened. And the OAS report was really quite a bad report. I mean, if you read the thing, it's really astonishing to think that that was taken very seriously. The report says the elections were very bad, quite bad. Something like 200,000 people couldn't vote. The election stopped really at 1 in the afternoon. But we can save the elections. And then they decided that number one was Maniga, number two was Martelly. And they gave the report to the government, and they essentially told the Haitian government, this is what's going to happen. And this is exactly what happened. The Electoral Council announced the results in February, but it announced the results in the most astonishing way. It did not give the results, because they couldn't give the results, really. It's impossible to give accurate results. They just said number one is Maniga, number two is Martelly, period. They've never given the official results, which is something that you need to have in order to go to the second round according to the Haitian constitution. You need also to have all the members of the Electoral Council sign the document saying that this is what happened, and only 4 out of 8 signed. And you need to publish the official results in the official document of the government. That was not done. In spite of it all, the elections went on, and we had the second round on March 20th. And that round was better organized, and it was very peaceful. But there are problems in the making. As I've said, the official results were supposed to have been published on Thursday. But the Electoral Council said, well, we can't publish the results. We have to have a delay till Monday, because we discovered that many of the tally sheets are fraudulent. And we need to look at all of the tally sheets very carefully. And that's why we are postponing the day when we will announce the official results. Now, the preliminary results, and you could listen to them on the radio on Sunday night, and I was listening to all of the results, and they were very clearly going in only one direction. They were going the direction of Martelly, something like 3 or 4 to 1. But by Monday, the Electoral Council said, you cannot do that. You cannot publicize on the radio the official results of the tally, because we don't want that. It's going to create instability, and we need to publish the results only at the very end of the process, which is also illegal, by the way, according to the Haitian Constitution. But the press stopped publishing those preliminary results. And as I've said, on Thursday, the Electoral Council will postponing the official announcement, and it is estimated, according to the Electoral Council, that something between 15 to 20% of the vote was fraudulent. This is not a small margin, but so about 20%, 15 to 20% of the tallies have been completely removed from the official count, which may present problems. Because yesterday, Martelly has declared that he won the election, that he won with 70% of the vote, and that he fully expects that on Monday those results will be confirmed by the Electoral Council. And he didn't say what would happen, but if history is a guide, it's very likely that if he doesn't win, his people will be in the streets. Now, Maniga has also claimed, she hasn't claimed that she won the election, but she claimed that she won the vote in 4 of the major regions of Haiti, which doesn't give you a clear victory, but should give you a victory even if you do poorly in the other areas. So you have basically 2 candidates that are claiming victory, and the results are supposed to be announced on Monday, and we'll see what happens. Now, To some extent, all of that is really a sideshow, because whomever is president is going to be very much part of a structure that compels him or her to do essentially what the international community wants him or her to do. There's very little room for maneuver. The country is totally dependent on external financial resources. The programs of the international community are the programs that are typically enforced, and that means that if history is a guide, that there will be an emphasis on the development of the garment sector, exporting clothing to the United States and to Europe. And the idea is that the comparative advantage of Haiti is ultra-cheap labor, so that's what Haiti should do. And the main plans that have been put forward after the earthquake are not very different from the old plans, in fact, they are very similar to the economic plans that were put forward in the late 70s when Jean-Claude Duvalier was president. In other words, export-oriented development, urban enclaves, and very little else. And if you are going to export agricultural goods, then they should be, in fact, mangoes and coffee. So the basic economic program as developed by the international community is to export those kind of specialized crops and to develop small industries linked to the international market using Haitian cheap labor. Now that program, as I've said, is an old program. It leads to disaster as far as I'm concerned. If you look at it, if you look at what happened in the late 70s, early 80s, you know, the garment industry created something like 250,000 jobs. The agricultural sector was completely neglected, which meant that you had a massive exodus from the rural areas to the urban areas. Haiti became increasingly dependent on not only foreign assistance, but also on imports of food. The economy was wide open, which has also meant that whatever industry we may have had in the past, they disappeared, they could not compete. And more tragically, it has meant that the agricultural sector has essentially collapsed. Haiti was, to a large degree, free from food dependence. We produced most of it in Haiti up till the late 1980s, early 1990s. And the paradigmatic example is obviously rice, which is something that is absolutely essential for any Haitian. We used to be independent. In other words, we were self-sustaining, and we did not need imports. But what happened in the mid-80s, was that the IMF and the World Bank told the government, well, you need to cut subsidies to the agricultural sector, and you need to import cheaper rice. And that was accelerated, actually, under Bill Clinton, when tariffs for rice went down to something like 3%, and there was a massive influx of cheap American rice. And this is one of the paradoxes. You see, the American rice is highly subsidized by the American government, but the U.S. and the other major powers tell the Haitian government, you can't do that yourself, you need to import our rice because it's cheaper, not surprisingly cheaper, because there are huge subsidies. And, you know, the rice that comes to Haiti is not surprisingly rice coming from Arkansas. Was done under Bill Clinton. And the paradox is that Bill Clinton, a few weeks ago, went in front of the Senate and said, well, that was a huge mistake. I should never have done that. But so far, Bill Clinton has done very little in terms of changing tariffs or proposing a different program. So we are stuck with that kind of open economy and dependence on the external world. And my personal feeling is that if you don't reverse those policies, if you don't dramatically change course, the country is really going to fall apart. And it's already in very bad shape, but it could get worse. Because if we continue to depend on importing food, given the fact that food is becoming increasingly expensive, you may find again that the population is going to be rather angry about it, and we had 2 years ago food riots, and this is likely to be repeated. So if there is no fundamental change on the privileging of the agricultural sector and of food production in Haiti, I think we are moving in a very bad direction. And so far, it is difficult to see how the country, even if you had a government that would want to change policy, how that government could in fact do so, given the constellation of power. So ultimately, the situation is rather bleak, and it remains to be seen whether the political situation will remain stable or will again plunge into great difficulties. And what has complicated matters further is that in the last 2 months, two very important figures of Haitian politics who are in exile are back in the country. One is obviously the former dictator Jean-Claude Duvalier, and the other is the former president Aristide. Both claim that they are not interested in politics, but that is really it's really implausible. Even if they don't want to be involved in politics, they represent constituencies that are quite important and that want them back in politics. So if there is a vacuum of power as a result of the current elections, if things don't go smoothly, it is very likely that you will see the former Duvalierists trying to get back, and clearly the forces supporting Aristide making a move also to reconquer, as it were, political power. So we are in a situation of great uncertainty, and only time will tell which way we are going politically. But in terms of the economy, it's unlikely there's going to be any fundamental change. I'll stop here, and if you have questions. So. Yeah.
Wonderful work with money that they raised on their own in the international community over the course of 35 years. And they bought land and done fantastic agricultural projects, housing, all kinds of things. My question, not being an expert in this field at all, why are all these NGOs, the 12,000 NGOs that are occupying Haiti, what, and also the international forces that hold all this money that was donated to Haiti, why are they holding the cash? And why are they doing this?
Well, the argument of the international community is that the structures are not in place. In other words, that if you put the money, it's going to be wasted. So you need to make sure that when the money is given, that it's going to be appropriately spent. That's the argument. The other argument is clearly that the government is so weak that it's difficult to see how you can give money to the government. And then there's obviously those are arguments. In reality, I think this is a policy that has been in place for a very long time. The whole idea of economic reforms, quote unquote, is that the government should actually be moved out of the picture and that NGOs should replace the government. And that has been the strategy. I mean, if you look, for instance, at the amount of money that was disbursed immediately after the earthquake, emergency money, out of every dollar that the United States gave, only 1 cent went to the Haitian government. So that tells you the government is really kind of irrelevant. Most of the money was actually spent on food, which is essentially American food, and a significant chunk of the money was spent on the military, because you needed to move the military planes, the military, etc. So something like 42 cents were spent on the military. 1 cent on the government. There was one part that was a good thing. About eight cents of that dollar went to cash transfers. In other words, Haitians working and getting a wage for, you know, cleaning, etc. But most of the money doesn't stay in Haiti. It kind of comes here, comes to Haiti, and then it goes back. And frankly, there are lots of consulting firms that are making a killing. You know, the so-called Beltway Bandits. You go to Haiti, you write a report, get tons of money. It's the same old game. So, but there is one issue which is problematic, and it's the fact that the government is so weak. The institutions of the state are so weak. Now, this is not something that just happened. This is a result of the policies themselves. The government was pushed aside. And to some extent, there were reasons why you didn't want to deal with the government, because it was very corrupt. But if you displace the government, there's nothing else, and you have a bunch of NGOs that are not coordinating their policies, and many of them don't know what the heck they are doing. And they've been in the country for something like 30 to 40 years, and the results are very meager. Now, there are some NGOs that do very good work, and that have been able to train Haitians who have taken over. But in general, there is no coordination, and there is a lot of competition between the NGOs for the money, and they have their own little fiefdom. So things ultimately are paralyzed. And Haitians are actually fed up. If you talk to the average Haitian, he's fed up with the NGOs, he's fed up with the international community, because they don't see results. So there is growing impatience with the international community, in spite of the fact the country is completely dependent on the international community. It's one of those paradoxes, one of those contradictions. But there is a feeling that, for instance, and that cuts across social classes, etc., that MINUSTAH should go. MINUSTAH is very unpopular. So, and they don't know what they are doing in Haiti at the moment. So there is growing nationalistic feelings. But on the other hand, there are very few realistic alternatives given the situation in the country. So it's really a very discouraging situation at the moment. And I'm not sure that whatever government we may have in the immediate future is going to change that condition dramatically. And one of the problems is the fact that whether it's Maniga or Martelly, they are going to bring their own crowd, which means that the existing crowd is going to have to be pushed away, or that you're going to have to essentially oil, if I can use that word, the machinery of the state by giving favors to your new crowd while keeping the other for political stability. And this is going to be, I assume that the international community knows that, because if Maniga becomes president, if they don't do that, they are going to be in trouble. So the international community must know that, you know, a significant amount of money will have to be used for illicit practices that are absolutely necessary for the stability of the country. This is simply a reality. Otherwise, you're going to get trouble. Then you're going to have to deal very quickly with the issue of the displaced people, the people in the camps. So far, they've been very patient, but I don't know how long that patience is going to last. And then you need to clean up the country. I mean, the rubble is still very much there. So it's a huge, huge task. You need to create state institutions. You need to provide jobs. All of that has to happen simultaneously, and it can't. So the question is, which priority is going to, in fact, become the priority? And that is not clear. It's not clear what a Martelly or a Maniga government would want to do. They have not given very clear indications of where they want to go. If it's Martelly, then, which I think it should be, I mean, from everything that I've heard, he should be the president, which is not necessarily the best thing. The fellow is a very popular fellow because he called himself President Compa, which means that he was the president of music in Haiti. That is fame, and that's the good part of it. The other part is that he was associated with the paramilitary groups and he was associated with the military, never himself as one of the directly implicated individual, but nonetheless, those were his buddies, which is rather distressing. Now he said that he's changed and that now he's a responsible person, et cetera, et cetera. And to his credit, he's had a very smart campaign. And this is why he's where he is. And he has a capacity, very much the same capacity that Aristide has to reach to the people. And in a very strange way, he has the same constituency that Aristide had, although he's kind of a right-wing populist. And Aristide was a left-wing populist, if you want to put it in those terms. But it's the same constituency. And he's very popular with the youth. His music resonates, but having him as president is rather puzzling, because no one knows what the heck he represents ultimately. So he's essentially presented himself as the candidate of change, and that's that. Whatever change means is something left to the imagination of everyone. And Maniga is a smart intellectual, she tends to be also conservative, but she's a competent person, but she doesn't have the same capacity to reach to the population, and she does not have a political base as such. She has the party of her husband, but as an individual, she doesn't have that kind of connection. She attempted to present herself as the mother of the country, who would take care of its children, but I don't think that ultimately that played well. But the Electoral Council will have to decide. And as I've said, the vote, who is the elected president, may have very little to do with the actual vote. Yeah. Sorry, I didn't hear.
You said there were few realistic alternatives for the country, which means that you must have some realistic alternatives. What are they?
Well, okay, so I said there are very few realistic alternatives. So the question was, what are those few? So what I hope is that whatever government to power will renegotiate the interim commission deal and will renegotiate the plans put forward by the World Bank, the Inter-American Bank, etc. In other words, that they will insist on having a very different agricultural policy, one that would lead to, if you wish, the revitalization of food production. I think this is absolutely critical. If you don't do that, what you're going to continue to see is a complete neglect of the rural sector, where you still have about 60% of the population living. You will continue to see massive influxes of population to the urban areas. And that, to me, is a recipe for disaster. The issue is whether whatever government comes to power would have the political will to go in that direction. And that's a big question, because most of those political coalitions are urban-based. And they have a small constituency, and that's where you get your support, that's where you get your money, so that's where you, that's what you're going to serve. But that would be the option. And the other option is that the international community would realize that if you want stability, you really need to change the economic policies, that they should reconsider their kind of dogmatic emphasis on just the garment industry and give a role to the government so that the government should function in such a way that it has a very important role, for instance, in education, a very important role for healthcare, etc. But the tendency has been to privatize all of those things. And if you privatize all of those things, that means that very few people have access to it. And people who are going to have access to those things are people who are going to be treated as if they were in a permanent phase of emergency, which creates dependence. So you move from a situation where the government doesn't do anything, so you have NGOs which are giving free food, free medication. For a while, it can be sustained over a long period of time. But in the meantime, this is one of the unintended consequences of the emergency period, is that virtually all of the hospitals in Haiti are in a dire situation, because they can't compete with free medication, with free support that, you know, when nurses would come, doctors would come. That meant that the Haitian doctors, you know, where are they going to get paid? And one of the other problems is that many of the nurses who had been working in those hospitals, well, they get better wages from the NGOs, so they move away from the Haitian structures. So you have all kinds of unintended consequences and very negative consequences. Same thing with when you bring food. You know, initially it's free, but that means that the local food production is going to fall apart because people can get it free. Medication is the same thing. So virtually all of the pharmacies in Haiti are in deep trouble because people are getting, have been getting for a while, free medicine. So those are unintended consequences of very well-intentioned acts, but they don't lead to the kind of self-sustaining development or the creation of Haitian institutions. So how do you do that? That's the puzzle. Well, I think theoretically you can have answers, but in practice, when you look at the foreign interest and the domestic interest, I am rather pessimistic. So in other words, I could give you all kinds of plans, but whether those plans could be effected given the political realities in Haiti and given the role of the international community, that's a very different proposition. What is clear is that whatever plan you have, it's going to take a long time. You're not talking about changing a country in 1 year, 2 years. This is something that's going to take very a very long period of time. But you can solve some of the immediate problems. I mean, for instance, the camps. That could be solved much more quickly. That's a lack of political will. It's not that you don't have land where you can put people. It's simply that the government doesn't have the political will to do so. And because there are all kinds of corrupt practices, because people who have the land or who claim to have the land want to get paid exorbitant prices for the land. That's the bottom line. You see, the government had no problem finding land when it was a question of building free trade zones. They just moved peasants away very quickly. But when it comes to finding land where you can put the people in the camp, that's a different ballgame. And this is a question of power. People in the camps are very poor.
All right, let's give Professor Fatone a round of applause.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you for your presentation and your lecture. And on behalf of the Alumni Association, we'd like to present you with this token of appreciation for participating in Black Alumni Weekend.